Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and welcome to your Friday. Isn't it nice that it's Friday already? It is August 4th, and we are looking at a nice weekend ahead. So thanks for being with us this morning. Yesterday, what happened with the weather here in the upper Midwest? It like was an instant polar plunge, and it was amazing how quickly it was chilly. And now today, I think it's going to be back to somewhat normal temperatures. But I saw in the news that it was the hottest month in 100 years in Death Valley. Come on. It's called Death Valley. I mean, it was certainly worse than scalding hot iron Arizona. But, I mean, when you have a name like Death Valley, expect hot weather. There's my rage for today. All right. This is in the news. Justin Bieber will not face charges for hitting a photographer with his truck. Apparently, the photographer was in the parking lot of the church as he was trying to leave. And he said no charges will be filed against him. But the photographer was trying to take a picture of Justin leaving church. How about just leave him alone for 2 seconds, okay? All right. Happy birthday if it's your birthday today. If it is, email me, bill@myfaithradio.com. I'd like to say happy birthday to you because it's also the birthday of the former president of the United States, Barack Obama. He's 56 years old today. And I can't believe after two terms, he's only 56. Still got a lot of future ahead. Maybe he'll one day get another job that will be equally as impressive as president of the United States. All right, we have a great show this morning. Carmen LaBurge from Reconnect with Carmen is going to be on. She is going to talk to us about the idea of praying the news. Because, you know, when you get up in the morning and you go, could there be more worse news out there? Everything you hear, story after story, is flat out kind of depressing. And there's something we can do about it as Christians. We can actually just start praying right through the news. I think she's going to coach us on that this morning. In Colossians 1:28, it says, He is the one we proclaim, admonishing and teaching everyone with all wisdom, so that we may present everyone fully mature in Christ. To this end, I strenuously contend with all the energy Christ so powerfully works in me. That is Colossians 1:28. We'll take a break. It is 6 minutes after the hour. We'll bring on Carmen LaBurge in just a minute. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Rebecca Maxwell taking a well-deserved day off today, and Neil Staven, program director and Connecting Faith superstar, is helping out with the program this morning, producing it while making faces at me.
It's a gift.
It is. And Paul Perreault is in the newsroom, and we have this morning Carmen LaBurge on. We look forward to speaking to her on Friday mornings. Reconnect with Carmen is her show. Carmen, good morning.
Good morning. I am also making faces, but no one can see them.
That's true. Well, Carmen, I sort of told the audience we were going to talk about your idea of praying the news, but I want to save that towards the end of our conversation, if that's all right.
Sure.
All right. So let's get on with some of the news that we're going to talk about that we need to pray through. For starters, the transgender agenda is really now pressing on all fronts, isn't it? What do we need to know about this?
So it really is. There really isn't a day that you can, see the front page of the newspaper or scroll through your news feed, however it is that you, take the news in every day. You literally now, a day does not go by that there's not a new headline featuring a story related to a person who is gender dysphoric, somehow in conflict with their actual biological male or female sex, who is now topping the headline news here in America. So it could be that you're reading a headline out of Oregon that says that these two men just gave birth to a baby. Okay, we read that. We know that that is disconnected from reality. We actually know in our hearts and minds that's not possible. And yet we are being asked to buy into this culture-wide delusion that says that a man can have a baby in America. And then the next day, you see the headline that says that This 8-year-old child in California is suing a private school for that school's failure. And by the way, it's a tradition. It recognizes itself as a conservative traditional school. And this 8-year-old, first of all, whose parents are empowering this, is suing the school in order to allow him to wear girls' uniforms and be referred to with female pronouns and use the girls' bathroom because he believes he is a she. Now, we read that and we say to ourselves, what has it come to? Like, where are we in our culture that the parents are no longer parents and the courts are also participating in what, again, I would describe as a culture-wide delusion? And then you have a person like Glenn Beck's guest this week, who is a biological man who is gender dysphoric and went through the entire transgender process, including gender reassignment surgery, and then, much like the prodigal, came to his senses, came to his right mind, and now embraces that he is Walt. He embraces that he is the man that he was created in the image of God to be and born to be. But now, you know, he is living with the consequences of having had a surgery that removed his parts. And so what do we do in the church with all of that? How are we preparing our kids for those conversations? This is the culture-wide delusion that we are now living in the midst of. And so how do we retain the truthfulness of what we know to be true from the scriptures? How do we speak those convictions with deep compassion, recognizing that gender dysphoria is actually a real diagnosable mental illness?
Good point. I remember when Caitlyn Jenner finally did her coming out, and then it was news on national news the next morning on all the shows. And one of the morning shows, there were all these really, you know, attractive morning TV personality types saying, oh, she's so gorgeous, she's so gorgeous. And I'm thinking, well, actually, it's a man in a dress.
Yeah, and so even when you and I buy into or participate in calling Bruce Jenner Caitlyn and referring to him as her or she, even when we do that, we are reinforcing the culture's delusion. So I am going to refer to Bruce Jenner as a person suffering from gender dysphoria. I am going to recognize that what he is doing is he is inviting all of us to participate in his delusion. I want you to think about that for a moment. I want your listeners to consider, would we do that for other people? If somebody said, you know, I genuinely believe that I am Jesus Christ, would we all participate in that delusion? No, we would say, okay, you are not. That is not reality. We would speak the truth into their life. We would stand with a firm conviction on what we know the Bible has revealed to be true about the reality of men and women, about God's good, beautiful, and true design for human life. We would plant ourselves there, and we would say we will not be moved. However, on this issue, much like on the issue of gay marriage and the normalization of homosexuality in our culture, even evangelical Christians have bought into this culture-wide delusion because we don't want to be described as hateful or bigoted, and we're just going to have to get used to being called names.
I agree. Carmen, sort this one out for me. Sonny and Cher's daughter, Chastity, she went through transitional, she went from being Chastity to being Chaz. And when she was Chastity, she said, I'm a lesbian. And then she becomes Chaz, so now she's a man in her mind. But she's dating a woman, so essentially she's also changed her sexual orientation as well, because now she's, I guess, heterosexual, right? If you're a man dating a woman, then you'd be heterosexual.
All right, so the conflict that you are having is that you think of these categories as linear, and in a postmodern mind, all of these things are fluid, and they exist along a spectrum, and a person can move between these different points along a spectrum, or within what I have heard one transgender person describe as a constellation or an orbit of possibilities. And so what you are identifying is part of the language problem that we have today. So people like you and I, we really need a new lexicon. We don't even have words for the categories that people are now speaking in. I was just this week that Gallup released this new poll about the rising moral acceptance of polygamy in America. So it was not that long ago that we would have said the word polygamy and everybody would have furrowed their brow and shook their head from left to right. And we would have been like, no, that's not something we're doing. That's not right. It's not legit. It's not moral. Well, 17% of our neighbors now think, you know what? It's really nothing morally wrong with polygamy. This is the challenge. And so we're going to need a lexicon now, because now polygamy doesn't mean what it used to mean. It now means polyamory. It means multiple relationships with multiple people, as long as all of those people are in it consensually. We have arrived at a place in our culture where we as Christians are going to be asked to participate in delusions that are so contrary to the way God designed things, and we're going to have to be able to stand where we stand, not only with conviction, but with deep compassion, because these are people who are living unawares, but they are living as like hostages to sin. They are certainly slaves to sin, and they are like prisoners of war. And so we need to treat them with compassion, but we have to stand where we stand with conviction.
I agree. Okay, Carmen, I have to go take a break so I can get a hot shower and scrub vigorously. And then when I come back, we'll talk about what's going on with President Trump and the monster leaks that are going on in the White House. It is 16 minutes after the hour. I'm speaking to Carmen LeBurge from Reconnect with Carmen. We'll be back in just a minute. And there is Carmen LeBurge's walk-up music. Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking to Carmen LeBurge from ReconnectWithCarmen.com. Carmen, all right, the president's a little humiliated, maybe a little embarrassed over the leaked phone calls from January that he had with a couple of world leaders.
Yeah, I just want to start with, I think a question. Can the president have a private conversation? And can the president have the expectation that people will protect his private conversations? Can he have the expectation that he will have staff members who will not only do what they're supposed to do, but resist doing what they're not supposed to do? Because that's really where we've arrived at. So I'm probably less concerned about the content of what has been leaked, and I'm more concerned about the leaking. And so I think that when we as Christians begin to participate in what really sort of feels like gossip. Now, I recognize that these were real conversations and they were had by our president with real global leaders. And I realize that the way the president characterized those conversations is now being characterized differently after people have read the transcripts. But here's the reality. What one person would regard as a contentious conversation, another person wouldn't. So you and I might have a very energetic conversation about a subject matter, and we would both know that actually it wasn't contentious. We wouldn't use that word. It wasn't. It wasn't a tense conversation. You and I were talking about whatever it was we were talking about, and we were working through it to whatever point of resolution we arrived at. And in every case, that's what's going on here. With the President of the United States, he is working. He is working through things with other people with whom he is on a par, and they should be allowed to work through those things in the kinds of conversations that are not then subject to, months later, people sitting around dissecting those conversations. Now, having said that, I am also a person who would say we need to speak the truth in whatever environment we're in. We need to do what is right every time in order that we don't have to make up stories about what did or didn't happen. And we're free to tell the truth about what happened if we're doing right, every time. So, the Bible is clear, whatever is done in the darkness, and I suspect the president now needs to live with the reality that whatever is done over the phone, even in private conversations, is ultimately going to come to the light. So you better be on your best behavior at all times across all environments.
Yeah, Carmen, do you think birthday boy Barack Obama ever had private conversations?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I also think he had people who fiercely defended his either. I mean, you can view it as a right of the president to keep some things from us, or in some cases you can view it as the responsibility of those around the president to shelter us from all of the information. There's a reason that the president of the United States has a briefing every morning that we are not privy to. Mm-hmm. Because, frankly, if you and I knew everything that was going on around the world, we wouldn't be able to get out of bed. We would be paralyzed with fear and anxiety and grief. And so we need to be praying for the president. I mean, that's not just a biblical mandate. I really believe that is a genuine calling of Christians in our nation. We need to be praying with him. We need to be praying for him. We need to be praying for those who are surrounding him, because this is a guy who has not spent his entire life swimming in the issues of what's going on around the world. And I think that he is still genuinely surprised every day at just how awful some things are. And that's a lot to learn to live with. And so that would take me, Bill, to the praying the news conversation.
Yeah, let's get there, because I'm excited to hear your take on this.
Yeah, so I don't want us to be paralyzed by the news. I don't want us to become fatigued of hearing it. I want us to feel called as Christians to do what we can do and do what we are expected to do, which is pray without ceasing. I think that when people think about when Paul said, you know, we ought to be praying without ceasing, that sounds kind of overwhelming, like we're supposed to have our eyes closed and on our knees and in some kind of meditative state. I actually think it means we are supposed to be so engaged with God about the conversations going on around us and the news happening in front of us that we are constantly inviting God's answers to those questions, God's participation in that person's life, God's sovereignty over whatever is broken down and failing, God's intervention in things that, you know, we can't reach. I cannot reach what's going on in Venezuela, but it breaks my heart. And I feel like, you know, if I'm walking in step with the Spirit, then what's breaking my heart is evidence of what breaks the heart of God. And so I want to be praying for what's happening in Venezuela. I want to be praying for what's happening with people suffering from opioid addiction. And then I want to be praying for their families who are suffering right along. I want to be praying for these families in Massachusetts where, you know, this young woman, Michelle Carter, was just sentenced yesterday to 2 years for this texting suicide case of her boyfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, think about the grief, not only of that individual and what she is surely suffering, but those two families. And I can't do anything about that other than pray, but pray I must. And so how do I pray the news as a barrier against gossip, first of all, but also as a way of entering into what God is trying to do in the world, recognizing that, you know, I'm his partner in that. I'm a minister of reconciliation. I'm an ambassador of Jesus Christ. What does that look like? What does that mean? That means I am going to pray the headlines, and I'm going to pray for the people involved.
Carmen, I love it. Now, I think when I get up in the morning, my communication tool with God needs to be similar to that of a walkie-talkie, something that's with me. It's always on. You can always sort of hear the static of it. You know, sometimes people treat God like like room service at night, right before they go to bed. And I think it's like a soldier on the field. It's like that's one of the most important tools you have is your walkie-talkie, so you can stay in contact with your commanding officer and your troops.
Yeah, and the line is always open. I think we have to remember that God is on the other end of that, and he is not mute.
So
you and I might be tempted to hit the mute button, but God is not mute.
No, he's always open. Now, Carmen, we just have about a minute left. Are you encouraged by the weekly Bible studies among Congress members in the Senate and including the Vice President, Mike Pence?
Yeah, I love this. I love that there's a cabinet Bible study. I love that there are Bible studies on the Hill. I love that there are, you know, groups of people on the Hill meeting to pray. And I love it that that the world is finding out about it, because this has been going on for a very long time. And the last administration did not embrace it in quite the same way that the current administration does. But there are actually Capitol Bible studies, Capitol Ministry Bible studies in Capitol cities across the nation. So it doesn't matter what state you live in, this is actually happening at the state level as well. And so this is exciting. I'm glad people know about it. I know that they maybe didn't all want to be outed, because now they have to actually, you know, say, hey, I am seeking God's counsel in the things that are happening in our nation and around the world.
Yeah. All right, Carmen. Neil just muted this, so this is a private conversation I'm having with you right now. How can I, Bill, pray for you, Carmen?
Well, I appreciate that. We have, you know, we have a lot of opportunity, and we, you know, we don't have the resources or the capacity to say yes to everything that we would like to say yes to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, huge praise that I've got a book coming out in September, and the final, like the final, final, I don't know, they keep saying it's final, the final, final edits are done. So that feels very liberating, and I'm grateful for that. I would say that, you know, that God would make it evident to us, you know, where are the doors that we need to be knocking on,
okay,
for wider distribution, so that, you know, more people can be hearing, and not just so that they can support the ministry, but so that we can keep doing what we're doing.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Carmen. Yeah. Great to talk to you. I'll talk to you next week. Neil, you can open the phone lines now to everyone so that everyone can hear again. All right. We'll take a short break and be back. Lots more coming up on the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's half past the hour. I'm not trying to get out of working hard today, but in the second hour today, Sam Sorbo is going to come in and guest host with me. I'm going to talk to her about her book about homeschooling, and then in the also we're going to talk about her new movie coming out with her husband, Kevin Sorbo, which is called Let There Be Light. That's going to be a very fun hour coming up in the second hour today. We'll take a short break for news and be back with Chris Martin. Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. Isn't it amazing how easy it is to feel ashamed after we sin? Author and speaker Christine Kane looks at a passage in Genesis which shows that God created us without shame.
Genesis 2:25 says, Adam and Eve were naked and they were unashamed. They knew no shame. And I have just found so many people have been so gripped by so many different forms of shame, I think more than even I thought was possible. And I keep going back to the Lord going, it's so interesting that just before the fall, the last thing you wanted us to know about how you made us was that we would feel unashamed and we would know no shame. And I think that to me is deeply personal, and it reflects that God wants us to be vulnerable, to be who we really are at our core, and that he created us not to be bound and shackled by feelings of unworthiness. And so I've got to admit, there hasn't been a day that I haven't been meditating on that scripture.
If you want to hear that whole interview, you can go to myfaithradio.com, and the author is Christine Kane. And because of her nice accent, she can say the words naked and unashamed on the Early Morning Late Show. We'll take a little break. When we come back, Chris Martin, our favorite millennial evangelical, is on the Skype line. We'll be back in just a minute.
The belief in the existence of evil is the line in the sand in all political discourse. This is Jim Garlow. Some politicians actually believe that the reason Islamists destroy others and themselves is because of external issues such as poverty. They can't bring themselves to believe these people would possibly be evil. Commentator Dennis Prager says, if the West does not begin to recognize evil, judge it, and confront it, it will find itself incapable of fighting those who would destroy us. You can't address the problem if you deny there is one. 1 Peter 2:16 says, live as free men, but do not use your freedom as the cover-up for evil. Live as servants of God. Evil exists, frankly, in all of us, you and me. And it has to be dealt with. And the restraining of evil includes trying to restrain evil in government itself. Be well-versed at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. 23 minutes until the top of the hour. My guest, Chris Martin, who we refer to as the millennial evangelical. He was born in 1990, so trust me, he is a purebred, and we love him on the program here. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning. How are you doing, man?
I'm good. So free speech on the internet in jeopardy, huh?
Yeah, I mean, depending on how you look at it, you know, studying, besides studying millennials, studying internet culture and studying how speech and communication takes place online is one of my favorite things to kind of research. And
mm-hmm.
honestly, they go hand in hand for obvious reasons. But yeah, I did some research recently on some data that Pew released a few months ago, back when I was still in school and didn't have time to read it or write about it. They did some research about the future of free speech online. And I kind of started my blog post this week. The title is A Stolen Frog and the Future of Free Speech Online. And if you paid attention to the 2016 election at all, you may remember this cartoon frog that kind of was in the news a good bit. His name is Pepe the Frog. And he was this artistic creation in an online comic from like 2005. Of this guy who just created this comic online, and he never intended it for it to be used by trolls during the 2016 election, 11 years after he created the comic. Mm-hmm. But it was, and it was used by particularly insidious trolls who were promoting this sort of like alt-right white supremacist ideology. And they would use this Pepe the Frog. Sometimes they would put like Donald Trump hair on it. Sometimes they would do various things. It was kind of like the mascot of these hateful groups of people, and it became recognized by the Anti-Defamation League as a hate symbol. It was the first internet meme to be labeled as a hate symbol. And this guy, his name's Matt Fury, who created Pepe the Frog in 2005. When he created it, he never had any intention of it being co-opted by these people or being used for the angry, hateful trolling that it was eventually used for. And so I see that as a kind of an interesting case study of free speech online, because his artistic creation, which in some part led to his success as an artist later on, was effectively stolen by a group of people who then used it as a means of communicating hate speech. And now his artistic creation is labeled as a hate symbol, official hate symbol by the Anti-Defamation League.
Wow.
And I think that's kind of that's a crazy story.
Oh, it's totally crazy.
Yeah, and so that made me think about the future of free speech online. And so Pew has this data on, you know, on the future of free speech online. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, trolling, which, if you're unfamiliar with the term, if you've never heard that term, it was a commonly used in the coverage of the 2016 election. But trolling online can be something as harmless as, you know, jabbing a friend and kind of making a sarcastic remark to them. That can be trolling, or, you know, spewing some sort of like racist hate because you think white people are better than every other race of people. Mm-hmm. That's also considered trolling. So a lot kind of falls under the umbrella. But what we have to address in the future regarding online communication is, how much do we want to police trolling, and what effects will our policing of trolling have on free speech on the internet? So there are different ways in which you can address the trolling problem. You can let it run rampant like it currently is. Mm-hmm. You can – that's maybe one end of the spectrum. Do nothing about it. The other end of the spectrum would be entering this sort of almost like government-enforced police state where trolling becomes illegal and anyone trolling can get a – fine or probation or something like that. So we really have to kind of count the cost of how we want to address this issue. But I do think the issue of hate speech online, trolling, you know, beyond the sort of sarcastically jabbing a friend, does need to be dealt with in some way or another.
So what do you think are there themes we can talk about for what the future is going to look like? Is there anything you can sort of forecast for the future for us?
Yeah, so Pew had a few different kind of themes or like ways in which they think we could address the trolling problem. And there's, you know, are long and drawn out and are great, but I kind of simplified them a little bit for my readers. So I'll simplify them here. And just I think there are four basic ways online communication will go in the future. And I think each one has positives and negatives to it. So the first is online communication will stay bad because people are bad, right? Hmm. So the human condition is broken. Christians recognize this as sin. Non-Christians recognize this. They just don't call it sin. And one possibility for future online communication is that we'll stay as bad as it is with no improvement. And that's bad in one respect, but it's good in that, like, we're not really limiting free speech right now. Like, we're not imposing any sort of severe penalty on people no matter what they say online. I think there's some good to that, right? Because we should be able to have free speech online. But at the same time, I don't want my friends to be trolled by people either. So I would prefer, you know, that's a pretty open, an open online communication climate, I guess you could say. A second way of addressing it is online communication will stay bad because there's economic and social benefit to trolling. So a lot of the 2016 election was defined by trolls. And if you wanted to put it this way, trolls won the 2016 election. The candidate that online internet trolls were backing in large part, their candidate won the 2016 election. So to what that communicated to a lot of the online community was trolling has its benefits. Trolling
sure.
works.
It works.
You can get the White House by being a troll, basically. Mm-hmm. So online communication will stay bad because there's tangible benefit to trolling. The third one, and this is the one I favor and I think might be the best solution. Online communication will improve because we will further segment ourselves online. Now, I say favor with a caveat. I don't think it's good that we segment ourselves online, but I think that that's probably what's going to happen. We see that already.
What does that mean, Chris? Segment ourselves online?
Sure. So like on Facebook, you choose who your friends are. If someone's sharing some sort of political or religious or some other sort of view that you don't like, you can hide their content without even unfriending them. So you can decide what kind of content you see on Facebook. You like certain things, you comment on certain things, you share certain things. And Facebook, their number one goal in life, other than making money, is making its users happy. And that's how they make money. So Facebook wants to keep its users happy. They want every time you get on Facebook to be a happy experience. Facebook is not designed to create intentional, honest dialogue between people who disagree with each other, unless that's what makes you happy. So Facebook and other social media platforms that are tailoring content that you like and allow you to personalize every piece of content you consume, they're doing that because they make more money when you are happier on their platform.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make more money when you are experiencing rational, honest, fruitful disagreement with people, because that usually doesn't make you happy, because you don't. Most people don't like to see things they disagree with on their social media feeds. And so I think because social media platforms kind of dictate how we communicate online, like they kind of get to set the rules, they get to set the parameters. I think that Facebook and other platforms will further segment us. I think that there are a ton of negatives to that, but I think that does kind of quell trolling a little bit, because that keeps us in our own little tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And that keeps us from fighting with other people. The fourth and final one, real quick, is that online communication will improve because we embrace a surveillance state that prevents it. And that's the one I had mentioned before. We could sort of embrace this, like, you know, there could be some new government agency that oversees all online communication. And at any hint of trolling, some agent emails you and is like, hey, I saw you trolling that random person on Twitter last night. You do it again, I'm going to impose a $50 fine on you. You know, there could be some sort of super I would call it oppressive situation where we're so afraid of trolling and hateful communication online that we impose some sort of like government induced protection against it. And I think that has more cons than pros, honestly.
Yeah. Chris, that's so interesting. Well said, well stated, good information. I'll take a break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about more of the just the odd and strange burden of participating in social media. We'll be back in just a minute with Chris Martin. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. It's 10 minutes until the top of the hour. I'll tell you what makes Chris Martin happy, and that is the Cubbies winning the World Series last October. And what a boom of babies that have come out of that, Chris.
Yeah. Wasn't that funny? I thought
it's
that
hilarious.
Story was so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I thought it was pretty cool.
And I thought the team did an amazing job of sending the trophy around to hospitals and letting people take pictures with it. And I just think what a great PR.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was a neat little feature, and it helps that the Cubs are starting to do a little bit better. Otherwise it would have been like, oh, don't remind me about the World Series last year right now.
Right. The law of unintended consequences. Let's talk about the strange burden of actually being involved in participating in social media.
Yeah, sure. So over the last year, I've become more discouraged about social media and what it's doing to us than I've ever been. I read this book by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death, which actually came out back in like 1985, 5 years before I was even born. And it was talking about the way TV is impacting us, how we communicate and how we consume information. And there were, even though Neil Postman wrote it, you know, 15 years before social media was even around, there were a ton of implications from that book about social media. And that's really kind of made me look at social media differently. And so I've been really discouraged about it. But the problem is, social media is central to my job.
Mm-hmm.
I coach authors on how to engage their audiences on social media. So some weeks I think if it wasn't part of my job, I would be off social media completely. Like I would kill everything. I would get off of every social media platform. But, you know, one of my friends left social media recently, and I've been talking to him about that, what that's been like, because he used to be really active on it. And he was really – like I really enjoyed interacting with him on it and things like that. And I was talking to him about it, and I think one of the reasons I can't, beyond the fact that I would be not as good as at my job if I left,
mm-hmm.
is I kind of feel this strange burden for it. And really the strange burden is just a stewardship thing, a stewardship issue. Social media can feel like a pretty godless place sometimes, but I feel this burden because I think it can feel so dark on social media, but the only light that I think can shine through the darkness of social media is the gospel. And I think if every Christian who is discouraged by social media got off of it, social media would just continue to be a darker place. And so mm-hmm. I sort of see social media as a sort of mission field and a way to engage people who may not believe the gospel with gospel action. And so one of the stats from Pew that I was kind of citing in this study is regarding online harassment. And some of the stats in this were just shocking to me. 42% of people, Americans ages 18 to 29, have experienced physical threats online.
Wow.
36% have experienced sustained harassment, so being harassed for a long period of time. 35% of people ages 18 to 29, so we're talking about kind of young millennials here.
Mm-hmm.
35% of young millennials have been sexually harassed online. 28% of young millennials have been stalked online. So like a third of young millennials have been sexually harassed online. 69% have been name called. 60% have been purposefully embarrassed, as Pew calls it. So like the numbers are ridiculous on the harassment that goes on online. So can it be redeemed? I think it can be. I think there are three basic ways that I'll run through with you real quick. Three ways that I think Christians can kind of redeem social media as a medium. First, I think we can create encouraging dialogue. So if you see a blog post or you listen to a podcast or something like that, and you see the person on Twitter or Facebook that created this piece of content, and find them on that platform and tell them that you were encouraged by what they had to say
mm-hmm.
publicly. Say, hey, man, I really like that blog post you wrote or that article or whatever. If you see a friend on Facebook who's made a Facebook post and it's clear they're having a rough day or rough week, shoot them a message and tell them you're praying for them and then actually do it. So much negative dialogue kind of permeates on social media and it gets all the press. I think it could use some sort of gospel encouragement from those of us who steward the gospel. So, and then second, share trustworthy resources. Share the content of Christian blogs or other websites or, you know, podcasts or whatever
mm-hmm.
whose content you trust. So many great Christian organizations and Christian leaders are blogging or creating other kinds of content very often. There's no shortage of faithful, trustworthy content online. So I would encourage Christians to share some of that or create some of it yourself if you're kind of creative in that way. And then third and finally, build sanctifying relationships online. Now, 10, 15 years ago, that would have sounded kind of weird. And to some, it may still sound kind of weird. But like there have been a number of friendships I've made that started first on Twitter or Facebook because we've, you know, it's another Christian blogger and we've interacted. And then at a conference, we'll meet and have coffee and really get to know each other face to face. So social media platforms are great places to find like-minded brothers and sisters with whom we may partner in our Great Commission work. So I think we can build sanctifying relationships, share trustworthy resources, and create encouraging dialogue. And that's where I think we can kind of share this burden of engaging on social media, because a lot of times it can be tempting to just completely disengage when I think we can actually do a lot of good.
Chris, I couldn't agree with you anymore, because that is a platform we need to take advantage of. So well said and well organized thoughts. You know, it's oftentimes people can become victims of their own industry. It's like the cleaning lady with the dirty house or the furniture salesman that has no furniture in his house because he just can't stand being around it. So, I mean, you certainly are, you know, at a place where you could fall into a trap where you get up in the day, in the morning, and all of a sudden you have to look at social media and you just, you're just repulsed by it at times.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, and it, you know, it goes through waves. You know, the 2016 election was a particularly dark time. But since then, you know, I've seen a lot more encouraging conversation, a lot less divisiveness. It's certainly, you know, like we talked about with the first article, there is still trolling and negativity, to be sure. But I really see it as a semi-neutral medium that Christians can kind of inject some gospel positivity into. Mm-hmm. And I think those of us who aren't tempted to sin, you know, strongly, my friend who left social media, it wasn't that he was discouraged so much. It's that he was like living for those retweets and those likes. And he had to kind of pull back out of just like a pride issue. And you know, I would say disengage from social media if it's tempting you toward pride and things like that. But if you can manage to be on social media without it leading you to sin with any regularity, engage on social media, encourage friends, have you know, constructive conversations with people maybe with whom you disagree, and you know, don't segment yourselves, and just inject some of that kind of gospel positivity that we've been given because Jesus saved us. I think that's a huge burden we have, and a lot of times it feels more like a burden and less like a blessing. But I think we really can bring the gospel to social media if we persevere.
Yeah, Chris, thanks so much for being on the show. Love having you, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Yeah, see you, man.
Okay, bye bye. It's 3 minutes till the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back with more of the Early Morning Late Show. All right, that wraps up hour one. What a great hour it was with Carmen LaBurge and Chris Martin. Coming up in the second hour, I'm going to have a guest host in studio. Sam Sorbo is going to be with us talking about her book and her movie that she's doing with her husband, Kevin, called Let There Be Light. How nice is this for me? I'll be back with hour two in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.